Welcome to tonight's forum. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. In the final installment of a three-part series recorded during a KKFI fundraising event back in March, Richard Wolff will conclude his discussion entitled Trump's Economic Strategy and What to Do About It. Wolff is a longtime economics professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and currently at the New School. He hosts a weekly radio show, Economic Update, and his efforts to promote worker co-ops through the Democracy at Work project have made him a leading voice for alternatives to today's grossly unequal economy. We'll start once again with a few minutes from last week's show to jog your memory before we dive into new content. Tonight, Wolff continues to describe what socialist and communist ideologies look like and how they can work in civil societies, citing maternity leave in France, American credit unions, and Shaker communities. At the end, Wolff takes questions and concludes by discussing his thoughts on the motivations for Trump's seemingly haphazard economic strategy. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the discussion.
Well, here's the solution that they have come up with in England. England, which is way ahead of us on this. England has something called the Labour Party. It's the number two party there. The conservatives are in power, the liberals are the outs, like Republican and Democrat. The head of the Liberal Party looks like, sounds like, and is like Bernie Sanders. The difference is he won. Jeremy Corbyn, name you should remember. Jeremy Corbyn is the new head of the Labour Party. About a year he's been ahead of it. Here's the plan of the Labour Party, folks. The plan of the Labour Party, if we win the next election, which I believe is next year in England, we become the government, and they have a perfectly good chance. The law, we will pass a law, and here's what the law will say. Any business in England that's now existing can continue the way it is. But if and when that business says it's thinking of closing down, or if and when that business is saying it is going to put itself up for sale to another business, or if and when that business decides to become a public company with shares and all of that, the law will say before a business can do any of that, it must offer what's called the right of first refusal to its own workers to buy the business. They have to do that. And now comes the best part. And where is the, are the workers in every enterprise going to get the money to do it? And Mr. Corbyn smiles and says the British government will lend it to them at a very low interest rate. And why? Because we are going to build in England a worker co-op sector of our economy. Everywhere. Everywhere. We're going to give the British people freedom of choice. If you want to go to work in a top-down capitalist undemocratic enterprise, be free to do it. But if you'd like to work in a democratically run enterprise, we're going to give you that choice. By the way, that's a choice that Americans don't have because we don't have that sector. Yet, we're going to be able to buy from a worker co-op or for a capitalist enterprise. You can choose. You can use your dollar to buy a shirt from one or the other. Make your buying power vote. So it's already happening around the world. Worker co-ops are a real, live, existing thing. The only amazing thing is why do we don't do it? And the American people will support this in huge numbers. You know why? Because in a way, and this is my closing comment, what I'm proposing, I'll be honest with you, this is what socialism is going to mean in the 21st century. It isn't going to be about the government taking things over. It's not going to be about that. It's not going to be the government planning and not going to be about that. Maybe secondarily, but not primarily. Primarily, it's going to be about a transformation in the daily work life of the American people. You're going to be a worker in a business you own and control in a democratic way with everybody else. And that's going to give you a better life. Everybody's going to have two job descriptions, the particular task you do and your role in running the enterprise. You're not going to have a choice, just like you don't have a choice. Oh, you want this job, you have to do these tasks. Well, you want this job, you have to do these tasks, which includes being a self-managed, self-directed worker enterprise. Wow. It's going to change all of us, our lives. We're not going to be as docile politically because we have practice every day in running our lives at work, we're not going to let other people do that in the community anymore either. And we're going to have the skills and the techniques to make decisions collectively. We're going to have a democracy that's real, finally, because we did what we were never willing to do before, make the economic system as democratic as we would like the political system to be. That's going to be a demand for socialism that's going to surprise our conservative enemies, because they're expecting an advocacy of socialism that's all about the government. We're going to fool them. This is an advocacy for socialism that comes from below, that begins where we all live our lives, and it will capture the American people with an enthusiasm of a socialism that means my life changes from tomorrow. I'm not waiting for a government to do it. I'm doing it, just like everybody else will be doing it. It's a vision and an image of a changing the society to make it stop being the unstable, unequal mess that we're in now. So we've done it. We've analyzed capitalism for its fundamental unacceptability, and we have offered a solution. And you know what that means? That means a level of maturity of the left in America. We've reached the ability to present clear, cogent critiques of the system and a clear, cogent alternative. That's all that we need to do. Now the tech task is go out there and recruit the people who share this vision. Will it be everybody? No, of course not. But it will be more than enough to move this country in directions no one has moved them for at least half a century. And again, this is now possible. That's why I have the nerve to say it to you in front of cameras that are going to repeat this everywhere. Do I look worried? I'm not. And I'm a cautious person. I would not be saying this to you if I thought it was dangerous. I'm not that courageous. But I've taken the chance. I'm the one the camera's on. All you have to do is go out there, think about this, and add your own component to making it happen. These can be incredibly, powerfully exciting times in the years ahead. And you can tell from my hair, I've been around a while. And I travel a lot, and I work hard. But I have to be honest with you in conclusion. And you could be able to tell it from looking at me. I'm having the time of my life. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So if you have to leave, do so quietly, because we're going to take some questions. Who's got one? Oh, great. Okay, so Spencer's. Okay.
How's go. This? Yeah, I can hear. I don't know if you can. When you were speaking towards the end, when you were talking about what could be, the room looked really quiet, and people had scrunched up looks on their faces. Why? That's a question for you. If you've seen it, I mean, is it because of the education that we are so afraid of change?
No, I don't.
So afraid of corporations and, you know, the power of all this?
I don't think we're so afraid of change, and I don't think we're so afraid of corporations. I think we're afraid of standing up and doing this. That's why I told the story about the crushing of the left after World War II. I think that's in our psyches, deeply down. It's dangerous, but I'm gonna use a couple of metaphors to try to get it across. I had two children, a son and a daughter. I have two children, a son and a daughter. And when my daughter reached puberty, like all parents, we began to wonder, how do we explain to her that sometimes the outfits she was getting on to go into the city got us nervous? You know, you don't want to be a fuddy-duddy, and you don't want to, you know, some of you have been in that situation. So how do you, well, we did our best. I'm sure it was mixed in the quality. Well, my daughter, who's much older now, and who is, by the way, a psychotherapist, perhaps because of how we didn't do it well, who knows. But she has talked to me often, now that she's a professional in this area, that how deep into the psyche of young women these difficult messages work. How years later she would go to buy a blouse and she'd go into the dressing room and try it on, look in the mirror. And if it had a certain look, she, even though she liked it, she'd put it away because it was that look that her mother gave her to understand and not a good idea. Don't do that. It's like that. It's this deep, unformed, inchoate, vague feeling. You know, there's these left-wing people and they're handing out a leaflet and they're calling for a meeting. And you know, I'm kind of interested, but you need to go to a meeting and maybe somebody will see me. Maybe someday somebody will remember that I was at that. And suddenly they don't go. They go bowling instead, or they watch TV, or they, you know, and they're not even aware, but it's a kind of anxiety. I'll be the only one. I'll stand out. I will be tarred with a brush. It's vague, but that's my sense. We have to overcome it. We have to get together and discover we are a lot stronger than we think. We are in less danger than we used to be. Look, we have a government right now that is spending a great deal of its time and money going and hunting down Muslims. Not us. People with a bomb in their shoe. Not us. We have space. We really do. And we have millions of people who want something. Millions of people decided that a man who accepted the label socialist, which was a death sentence for a political person for the last half century, Mr. Sanders, 13 million people of fellow Americans voted for him. They weren't upset by socialist. It's not what it was. That's why I work at that. It's not the way it was. I travel everywhere, all over the country. I've been doing it for 4 years. My meetings have the feeling and the spirit that they do tonight. I look at you. I've been a teacher all my life. I can see if I'm boring the audience or if they're all wondering when they can get the hell out of here, et cetera, et cetera. I can see. I know what I've got. I got people that are engaged with this. They may have crunched up faces, but they're thinking about it. I can see. They've not left. You know, even those that are giggling, I can see they're giggling. They're giggling at the right moment. I'm getting it across. So I think it's this vague fear. I don't know how exactly you undo that. And remember, it's been sitting here for 40, 50 years. That's a long time. Your grandmother gave it to your mother, and your mother gave it to you, and your father, and your uncle, and every family has a story to tell about Uncle Louis over there and back in the 50s, and then he went, and somebody said they saw him at a... These are stories that become part of the lore of every family. There they are. There they are. So that's my guess, sir.
Okay, so if anyone's interested in forming worker co-ops, please let me know, or let someone at KKFI know and they'll let me know. We're looking for businesses. Already have city council people that are interested in promoting it, and also people with the STAR. And the second thing, if anyone wants to form a book club, let me know. I mean, after you've read the book and you want to talk to other people, we can coordinate this with KKFI also.
Yes, good. And we'll help from New York City and Democracy at Work. We'll help work with Mike and others to help you do that, to build. That's what we're doing all over the country. We have, I should mention, Democracy at Work now has active groups in 15 cities across the United States. The most recent one, the addition in Phoenix, Arizona. But we have them in the Los Angeles and New York City and San Francisco and Tampa, Florida, and all kinds of places where people are beginning to become active. You should be aware also that two city councils, one in Madison, Wisconsin, and one in New York City, have now allocated $2.5 million in New York, $5 million in Madison, Wisconsin, to help develop worker co-ops in those communities as part of the economic development of those cities. That we're working on that all over the country. We're becoming a political advocacy forum to push for this kind of thing. And we have all the arguments that I've just kind of summarized for you as to why this is appropriate and why this is necessary. And I've appeared before city councils, and I've talked to congressmen and senators. I can tell you this, as they like to say in Washington, this proposal has legs. It has some traction. It moves because it's new and it's different, and it offers concrete examples like the Mondragon or Italy or...
Four towns in Washington.
What?
The food co-op in four towns in Washington is bigger than any grocery store there.
Right. And co-ops are all of all different kinds. We focus on worker co-ops, but consumer co-ops like the food co-ops around the country, credit unions, which are basically co-op bank type of situation. There's a lot of this. This is very old in the United States. If any of you wanted to see an example, by the way, of an early American co-op, very profound worker co-op, then go up to Pittsfield, Massachusetts, unless you have nearby communities. The Shakers, you all know the history of the Shaker movement. Are you with me? The Shaker. It's an early American Protestant religious community who, I think this is okay to say, right? It's not a church. Okay, they didn't believe in sex, so that's why they shook. They got together and everybody, no, seriously, folks. Well, hold it. It's not meant to be comedic. They had shaking ceremonies where they discharged the energy that you might otherwise have discharged in another way. Okay, I'll leave it at that. And as somebody, I heard someone say, well, this makes problems for the long-term survival of this group. How did they've existed to this day, so they obviously solved that problem. You might be interested to know how they solved it. Starting in colonial days, Shaker communities, and if you ever want to go Pittsfield, Massachusetts, there is a continuing Shaker community that will take you through like a museum and show you what a worker co-op was and how successful it was. Here's what they did back in colonial days. They let it be known that any woman seeking to escape an abusive relationship with a man, presumably her husband, could come at any time of night and day with or without her children to a Shaker community, and with no questions asked, she would be taken in, so would her children. They would be clothed, they would be fed, they would be housed, and no information about them to any authority would be made available. That's how they survived. This was the first American abused woman program. Or battered woman shelter type program. Okay, the Shakers did that. What an interesting story. And you know how they did it? They integrated those women immediately into the worker co-op to help develop, and they made the decisions in common, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and how to share. I mean, they did it all within the framework of their Christian rituals and beliefs, but who cares? You know, there are nuns and monks in the Roman Catholic Church who collectively produce jams and all kinds of other stuff in a collective way like this. So, or fudge, or yeah, you name it, they do whatever. But the point is, these are old human beings have tried to develop collective cooperative enterprise for a long time. I think now its historic moment to become a general way is here. And I think the religious folks may surprise us because they may see in this a way to make the religious commitments they have actually mean something in daily life rather than be those funny things we say on Sunday before we go back to our real lives and live them in a way that is contradicted by the stuff we do on Sunday. Anyway, yeah.
One thing that I remember hearing from about you on one of your podcasts is that you have a lot of French relatives. And with the upcoming election in France and the fact that there are two socialist candidates, we're lucky enough here to get one, I just wanted to know if there was one that you support or if there were any ideas of these candidates that you particularly liked, Benoît Hamon and Jean-Luc Mélenchon, if there's either one that you particularly like or right. Another candidate altogether.
Yes, well, my father was born in France. I speak French. I have all my life. And I have relatives in France, so I keep up with it. And I like to talk about France because it's a way for me to provoke Americans.
So both.
I'm going to give you three examples. And once again, if you don't know what I just tell you now, that's another quality of your education system. Here's the law in France. You are covered for your medical insurance from the day you are born to the day you die. End of story. And that's been true for many decades. So what Americans can't figure out how to do, the French, and they're not the only ones in Europe, but most Europeans are like this, have solved. Number two, when you enter the labor force in France, you graduate high school, or if you go on for more, you graduate college. When you enter the labor force, the law in France says that your employer must give you 5 weeks of paid vacation every year. Do you understand that? Most of you will not get 5 weeks of paid vacation ever. They get it starting when a 19-year-old who's finished high school, that's what they get. And when you ask them why, they say, because anything else would not be a livable life. A human being needs to have time off. If you're married, you need to have time to work out your relationship with your partner. If you have children, you need to be able to give them the kind of undivided attention that you can never do when you're working a regular job. For them, the notion that Americans don't have this, can't look forward to it, and that millions of Americans now have now jobs that have no vacation at all, they don't believe it when I say it. They don't believe. Here's another example. In France, if you have more than one child, if you have a second child, you get a subsidy from the government for every child after number one to help you pay for the cost of feeding and clothing and schooling the child. It's an obligation of the government to help you so that having children doesn't become a burden financially because it'll undermine your affection, your love, your care. Does it strike you as reasonable? It should. Yes, if you have another example. You have many, many weeks of paid maternal leave for the husband and the wife. You get it? Maternal paid leave, paternal paid leave, because a child should have access to the father too. Ha, whoa, what a weird idea. I could go on for a long time. Ask yourself whether the American working class knows this. They don't. And ask yourself whether that's an accident. It isn't. Now the French political scene. Why do the French have this? Because they have a powerful left that was never crushed after World War II. The effort was made, it didn't work. So for example, they have two left-wing parties now. They have the French Socialist Party, and they have an anti-capitalist further left party. The French Socialist, just for those of you who may not know, is now the government. The president of France is a socialist party leader. And the National Assembly, which is the most powerful of the two houses, is dominated by the Socialist Party. So the socialists are running a candidate, a left-wing candidate. The anti-capitalist, Mélenchon, is a further left party. The two together, they don't run together, they're two separate parties. But if you put together the polls that the two get, they get more than Marine Le Pen, who's the candidate of the far right. If you read American newspapers, you wouldn't get that. If you read the polls, you see it right away. That's why they have these things, because the unions and the communists and the socialists and et cetera, da, da, have fought for these things, and they make it too difficult to undo them. Even right-wing politicians dare not touch this. No candidate is saying, we shouldn't have 5 weeks paid vacation, we should only have four. And you know why they don't? Because they would lose all their votes. It's over. So they don't dare. They don't take away any of this. 4 years ago, I was in France at the I go to visit my family. I'm in France. It's in May. The French in May have to go into the streets and demonstrate about something. It's just part of their who they are. And, you know. So if you want to be in a demonstration in France, go in May, and there'll be one, or six. So it was May, and there was a demonstration. Why? Because the government, it was not yet the socialists, the government had proposed to cut back the free daycare that is provided to French citizens in Paris. And it turns out that many of the daycares are located in the basements of Catholic churches. And the government pays a rental to the church for having the daycare center there. I mean, you have that in the United States too. So anyway, the conservatives made a bill to slash these subsidies for these daycare centers. So the French immediately said, into the streets, this is no good. And the Communist Party led it. So we come out of our hotel, and there's a demonstration. And my wife and I have the general view, if there's a demonstration, we go. Okay. Afterwards, we ask, what was it about? You know? Well, we're so eager to have the United States be a place that does this, that we just need to get into it when there is one. So we go out, and we go in, and we start talking. But before we get very far, we notice something. Leading the demonstration is the city of France is divided into districts, and the names of these districts is called arrondissement. It's the name of the sector. And so the flags of the people at the head of the demonstration are all red. It's the Communist Party chapter of the 8th arrondissement. Okay? Well, that makes a certain sense. Communists will go out, they'll be well for that. Right behind them, the Church of Saint Xavier. 10 nuns carrying Church of St. Xavier. But the only thing that was odd was the nuns were arm in arm with the communists. That's France. They all know each other. That church is right next to the communist. They have lunch every day. And the government, taking a look at the fact, if you're opposed in France by the communists and the church, you're done. It's over. And the government withdrew the bill. I can see from your faces. Let me give you a lesson in European politics. Every Italian family, every French family, every Spanish family, every Portuguese family, and most Greek families have in them a communist. You know who the communist is? It's Aunt Louise, the one who makes those really good sandwiches when we have picnics. It's the one that your nephew ran to when he hurt his knee and he fell off his bicycle. He ran to Aunt Louise because she's so nice and warm. When you say to a population like that, watch out for the communist, everybody goes, what the hell are they talking about? Communist? That's Aunt Louise. She never heard a flea. She's my best friend. You can't demonize because everybody knows one or two. And they're just like, you and me. Can't do it. I said, it doesn't go in those countries. That's why people keep voting for socialists and communists, because it's your neighbor, it's the guy who makes the coffee for you, it's your coworker, it's your relatives. Demonize them? You just dropped off your children at their house. What are you going to tell me? I'm in danger? I'm not in danger. You're crazy. This makes it very dangerous for political movements. The United States is a place where you could demonize because you got rid of them first, made them very distant, very strange, and now you can tell them anything. Because there's no counterweight in the cult. You can't do that in Europe. You just can't do it. By the way, Portugal. Why did I include Portugal? Little detail. Another example of what you may not know. The government of Portugal today is a coalition of three political parties. The Portuguese Socialist Party, the Portuguese Green Party, and the Portuguese Communist Party. That's the government of Portugal. It's been that way for a couple of years. And if you didn't know that, gee, maybe it's because the New York Times doesn't mention it. Except at the end of a 27-column story, right next to the advertisement for handbags. But I didn't make that up. Just look it up. You'll see. Yeah.
So you mentioned what the U.S. did here in the U.S. about socialism and communism, but also in Europe. It seems like a lot more money was spent through the CIA in the 50s
40s and 50s and 60s to try to wipe out socialism, communism there. Huh. Can you give some insight?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the historical, you know, we have a, there's a 50-year rule in the United States State Department and government documents. You can only release documents after 50 years. That's a rule in part because the assumption is that the people mentioned in these documents have now died or gone on, and so you can begin. Not everything is released, but there's a kind of a general, called a 50-year rule. So it's now about, you know, half a century since the post-war period. And it turns out, yes, the United States government was financing anti-socialist, anti-communist movements, political parties. You know what we were doing? We were interfering in every single election. The thing that we're so angry that the Russians are doing, they really shouldn't do that. That's an American obligation. It's not for other countries to do so. How nasty of them, how outrageous that they should do to us what we do and have been doing for half a century across the world. But don't tell anybody I said that.
I know in a previous update you mentioned how some of the big banks had put out a red alert on the stock market. I wonder if you could comment on our current economic outlook, and does Mondragon give tours, I wonder?
Yes, Mondragon will give you a tour. You just get, they have a big, they're missionaries. They want to help develop worker co-ops all over the world. Not only that, there are American groups that regularly take people on those tours. If you're interested, you know, talk to me at the end. I'll give you the name of them. Multiple people are doing that. By the way, some of you may be interested. There's another experiment in building worker co-ops going on right now, much closer than Spain. It's in Cuba. The Cuban government decided about 4 years ago to change the direction of socialism, building socialism in Cuba, before Castro died, Fidel Castro died. And the decision was, we're not going to rely on government enterprise, government the way we have been doing. We're changing to focus our future on worker co-ops. And the Cuban government is creating them and subsidizing them and building them. And if you want to see that, which you can now do because we have diplomatic relations with Cuba and airlines fly there all the time and there's no prohibition on Americans going there. And the Cubans also offer trips to go. The University of Rhode Island, I happen to know, regularly takes students and interested people to Cuba where they have a relationship to allow students that are interested from the University of Rhode Island to go there. There are other people that go to Mondragon and so on. There's no problem at all. They are eager to show you what you're doing. And obviously, if you go to Mondragon or Cuba, it would be better if you spoke Spanish because then you can have direct interactions with those people, ask them what they feel about it and how, what experiences they've had and directly interact with them.
Okay. First off, I want to say I went to Mondragon and I interviewed them and I did it. I translated it into English.
Even better.
And if you go to the Heartland Labor Forum webpage and go back to mid-2015, you can find that show.
Good.
All right, and learn about it. We're going to take one more question from Greg, and then I have a final question. And then if you have questions, I'm sure Rick will stay around for a few minutes afterwards. But I also want to say we have two books left and of his book. And so if you'd still like to purchase one, please do. We don't want to send them back to the publisher. So, Greg.
You mentioned co-op banks. And given the political climate that we have right now, I'm really wondering whether anything could get past, you know, where the government would be financing that sort of thing. So I was wondering if you might describe, are there successful co-op banks and how that might aid what's being done here, you know, in terms of financing co-ops?
Okay, two quick answers. I don't need to tell you because you all know that a government dominated by Mr. Trump as president by the Republican Party in both houses means that getting something progressive through there is, you know, a rich man through the eye of the needle and all of that. I can't comment. I have nothing to offer that you don't already know about the difficulty or the long shot nature of doing anything like that. What I can tell you is even Republicans, if you light a fire, a political fire under their rear ends will begin to move because it's hot and they don't want to be burnt. And that's what we're in the business of doing. So let me answer the question about co-op banks. Well, first let me explain to you that in the United States we have co-op banks. They're called credit unions. A credit union is a cooperative bank. It's where a group of people, usually at a workplace, this is what mostly starts, get together and say, instead of putting my paycheck in a bank downtown, I'm going to put my paycheck into the credit union, and I'm going to, you know, write my checks and have my credit card the way I do at a regular bank. But when I make a loan, I will pull my money. And so what it is everybody who works there being a cooperative bank. So we don't need to start from zero. We already have that. If you're not aware of it, the big banks in America have been very frightened by co-ops, credit unions. So they have passed lots of legislation that limit what credit unions can do. That's why they aren't much bigger than they already are. And there are about 100 million Americans, roughly a third of Americans, that have something to do with a credit union. So it's already very big. But they are not allowed to make certain kinds of loans. They are not allowed to do, because the big banks don't want the competition from them. That could be changed by political effort, and that would allow them to offer many more services, which would make them even more competitive to the private bank that most of us are now relying on, number one. Number two, many European countries have had cooperative banks for decades. Most savings banks in Germany are co-op banks, because the Germans, this will come as a shock, they don't want and they don't allow private banking and savings. They don't allow it. They won't have it. It's like we don't allow a private fire department, do we? You want fire protection? You call the fire department. What fire department? The government fire department. You can choose not to call them, but then you're going to have trouble with your house. So you call them. We live with it. We don't have private police, although we have a little of that. We don't have much of that. Most of us don't allow private parks to replace our public parks, and we limit the private beaches so we have access to the beach, and on and on. And they've just made banking part of that. It's too important for the economy. It has too many social effects to leave it in the hands of institutions whose first priority is private profit. Really ask yourself, this is an economics question. Does it make sense for something that the whole society needs and relies on, like the money supply, being able to earn money and spend money and store money, all the ways we use money. Does it make sense, when we all depend on it, to put the control of it into the hands of an institution whose first priority is to make a profit for itself? It's not rational to do that. It's good for the private banks.
The Fed? Is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm talking about private banks. Private banks, for those of you who don't know, and you should, because this is called modern monetary theory, and its home is UMKC. So you are in a place which explained to the profession that money is created by private banks, because when you go to get a loan from a private bank, they create a checking account for you. Bingo. Can they do that whenever they want? Uh-huh. Are they limited in that? Not really. They just do that. Okay, that's very interesting. But you're now putting the question of how much money there is in circulation in the hands of people who make a decision that impacts the entire monetary system based on what's profitable for themselves. That's not a smart way of doing things, is it? Come on. These are not complex issues. So the answer is, there are co-op banks around the world. They would immediately, by the way, I've met these people whose economists come to conferences I go to, they would be happy to share their 50-year history of cooperative banking with Americans who wanted to do it. It's a little bit strange, and let me end with this, it's a little bit strange to explain this to an American audience. You just saw, over the last 4 years, the biggest banks in America be either found guilty in the courtroom or guilty in government regulations of violating our trust in every activity they do. Let me go through it. Big banks have been caught and had to pay billions in fines for laundering money, knowingly handling criminals' money to enable that criminal enterprise to succeed financially. They've been caught manipulating global interest rates, a so-called LIBOR scandal, where they got caught. They've been manipulating foreign exchange rates. They recently got caught at that. They mishandled the mortgage crisis in 2008 and have had to pay big things. And they've overcharged you for everything from bounced checks to everything the banks do, they stole from us. And what is the discussion in the United States? Rules and regulation. Huh. We already had rules and regulation. It didn't work. More of them? You gotta be kidding. They got around them, they evaded them, they undid them. In the case of Glass-Steagall, they literally repealed them. Stop. Why in America is nobody saying, let's see, every single big private bank has ripped us off in every business that it does. Maybe we shouldn't have private banks. Yeah. What? One last thing. And for those of you who don't know, we have a model for how to not have private banks, because one out of the 50 states in the United States doesn't allow private banks to function for the state. It's a state that takes all of the money, all the taxes paid by the people in that state in the 50, all the hunting license purchased, all the car licenses purchased, all the permits to put a dog run in your town, all that money is given to this state, which deposits it in the public bank owned and operated by the state, thereby saving millions every year that they would have otherwise paid to First National Bank or Citibank or Wells Fargo or any other big ones. This state in the United States has done that, run its own public bank for the last 100 years. That's right. The Bank of North, a really typical progressive American state, North Dakota. The farmers and, you know, folks in North Dakota have not let any governor, Republican or Democrat, touch it. They have repulsed every effort by the big banks to get rid of that. The people of North Dakota love the bank that serves them. And when the end of the year comes and the bank shows its profits from taking in deposits and making loans, the Bank of North Dakota takes the profits and gives it to the state of North Dakota, which owns it. And therefore, the state of North Dakota charges less taxes to its people because it doesn't have to raise as much money in taxes, because it saves all of that and takes the profits of its bank as part of the revenue for the state government. Does it sound reasonable to you?
Yes.
Don't know about it.
We can use that in Kansas.
If the North Dakotans can get away with it, what's wrong with Missouri?
Or Kansas.
Okay, one last question. I want to thank you all for coming, first off, and keep listening. Keep giving us your ideas for KKFI. We want feedback from the community, and keep supporting KKFI. Okay, I don't want to get a charged with bait and switch. And we titled this talk, because you said you'd do it, the Trump economic plan. So do you want to give us just, I know it's early in the administration. I know that the media persists in calling him a populist. So what the hell is he as far as his economic plan?
Okay.
Or does he even have one?
Yeah, sure, he does. Good. I'll try to be as brief as I can. As you know, Mr. Trump upended the Republican Party by defeating all the traditional candidates that they had put up, many of them perennial candidates, and came out of, I was about to say left field, but I'll say right field, to become the Republican nominee, and then basically did the same thing to the Democratic Party establishment, pushed them aside, and so here he is. What that means is he comes into office with two enormous deficits. He doesn't have the support of the Republican Party, not really, they don't like him, and he doesn't have the support of the Democratic Party, they hate him too. Okay, this is difficult for a person to become the president with so little support. He got a lot of votes, but it's not clear how strong that support is. So his economic plan, such as it is actually disguised as the more important priority for Mr. Trump. He's got to find and build support, and he's got to do it in a hurry, because he risks being isolated as the kind of weirdo it's kind of easy to portray him as, and with his enemies in the Republican Party and his enemies in the Democratic Party and a population that, remember, he was elected with a roughly 17-18% of the total eligible voters in America who voted for him. That's all it took to win in the general election. So his first priority can't be this or that. He's got to build support or else he's dead. So step number, but it has economic implications. Step number one, he's got to make sure that the people who could bounce him out of office, and I know this is difficult for Americans who don't think like this, but in every other country you do, and we have to catch up. So the first thing he has to do is make sure that the people who could bounce him out of office in 10 minutes won't do it. That's why he gives $50 billion to the military. That solves that problem. The military didn't even ask for it. You have nothing to worry about. I'm giving you more money than Jesus has. Here we go. Boom. No question. Do whatever the hell you want with it. Here it is. To fight against ISIS. Oh, yeah, sure. Fine. I'll say anything. You say it. Who cares? I'm your friend. Don't mess with me. Problem solved. Number two, curry favor with the Republican Party and the Republican Party base. The wealthy people who are the overwhelmingly dominant supporters, financially, of the Republican Party. How do you do that? There are two ways to do that. Number one, get rid of Obamacare. Why? Because it's a tax on the rich that paid for it. By getting rid of Obamacare, you drop the tax on the rich, and that's what it's about. And he can deliver to that important base an enormous prize, because it's big money that they had to come up with. I mean, these are very rich people, so for them it isn't a lot, but it's a lot of money compared to what they had thought they would have to pay. And since they were all covered with health insurance, they don't basically want to pay for other people's health insurance. Very American. Very nice. So what do? You get rid of Obamacare. Number three, you cut the corporate income tax. From 35%, his proposal, 15. That's a hefty cut. Maybe 20 will be a compromise. That's saying to the entire business community, I'm your friend. I'm going to cut your taxes like there's no tomorrow. Number four, I am going to, ready? I'm going to really, really have an infrastructure. I'm going to build roads and bridges and harbors and all of that stuff, and that's going to be fat contracts for many of you. This is so the business community loves him. The financiers in Washington, in New York and Washington, love him. He's giving them an Easter basket full of colored eggs of the sort they like, tasty ones. Tax reduction, regulation reduction, infrastructure building. Get rid of Obamacare. It's a wonderful thing. So there, he got there. He's got there. Now we get to the hard part. He's going to bring back jobs and good incomes to the mass of American people. And here what we get is, we get nothing. We get theater. We get an afternoon tweet every day that provokes us into hysterical yellings and screamings about something that we can all get excited about and have 4 days of endless, boring news programs to watch on television with details that, you know, become foggy in our brain, because in the end, we kind of somewhere know this is all theater. Let me give you just two or three little examples. One, I'm going to put a tariff on those goods from China and Mexico, and so they'll be very expensive, you see, and then Americans won't want to buy them because they're so expensive, because I put a big tax on them, and so they'll be produced here in America because it'll be cheaper to make them here than to pay high tariff taxes on bringing them in, and that'll make jobs in America. Sounds plausible. You hand this in to an economics professor, you get a large F. Let me explain to you why. One, if you did this, if you put these tariffs on China, I'm going to scare you now, but you asked. You are attacking China. You are declaring war on China. Why? Over the last 30 years, 400 million people have been moved off the countryside of China in its rural areas to the coastal areas from Beijing in the north to Hong Kong in the south. They are all working in factories that produce exports for North America and Western Europe. They can't go back. There's no place for them. There's no work in the rural areas they can get. They have to stay working. And if you put a tariff, you're closing them off. And that is an attack on the Chinese society. There's no work for them. They die. They will turn against their Communist Party government, and you will have a catastrophe in a country with nuclear weapons. You really want to do that? Really? Not going to happen. And Mr. Trump will have to twist and tweet himself into oblivion. Can't be done. Second example. You want to do that to Mexico. Mexico is already a society that's half in the bag. There are large parts of Mexico that the Mexican government does not control. I assume you know that. Mexico has lived for the last 20 years off of two crucial things. The ability to take Mexicans who cannot work in that country because there's no work and send them to North America where there is. And when they get to North America, these Mexican immigrants take a huge portion of what they earn and they send it back to their families. This solves Mexico's problem. It gets rid of people it can't employ and has an enormously important export, money coming in, they can't get any other way. Right now, you are threatening with your immigration policy and your tariffs to kill them. That puts on your southern border a collapsed society. We're not going to be reading about the disasters of Iraq and Afghanistan that are 10,000 miles away. We're going to be reading about them in some place you can go in a few hours in your car. Think about it. That's not a viable option. You can't do that. But I'm not done. What will Americans do if there are tariffs? You can't buy this stuff unless you pay very much higher prices because you got to pay a tariff, and Mr. Trump does that. It means your shirt, your socks, your sandals, your toaster, it's all going to jump up, huge price. You know what that does to your standard of living with your wages? You know what that's going to do to the American people? It's going to make them very angry. And you know what they're going to do? They're going to go to their employer and say, you've got to give me more wages. I'm eating cat food here, and I don't like cat food. And I'm going to make your life unpleasant. The employers of America want to have a mass uprising of the working class to get the money to simply keep their standard of living, to match the prices that are going up because the government raised the tariffs. You know what corporations are going to do when that begins to kick in? They're going to turn on Mr. Trump and they're going to say things about him that are more vulgar than what he says about other people. He can't do these things. He can't do them. And that's why it's theater, and that's why it's tweets, and that's why it's noise, because what he's delivering and offering to the working class is blah, blah. He can't do it. He can't do it.
General Motors won't go for it.
Nobody's going to go for it. And if it actually worked by some miracle, which I can't foresee, but it's always possible, it would mean that Americans would now get these jobs. Americans demand much higher wages than what we've been paying in Bangladesh or Mexico or China. Americans would demand much higher wages. You know what that creates as an incentive? This is how capitalism works. If the worker becomes more better paid, with each increase in the wages of the worker, you've created a bigger incentive for the capitalist to replace the worker with a machine, whether it's a computer or a robot. That's the way capitalism works. The more successful the working class is in raising its standard of living, the greater the incentive for the capitalist to deprive the worker of his job. If that strikes you as an awful bind to be in, well, that's why we're against capitalism, because that's how it works. You know this, but you've been hesitant to put these pieces together. He can't. So even if he did it, and if the wages went up, the next response of the business community would be to robotize this stuff right out of existence. We're stuck. We live in a system in which capitalists have learned to use moving the job abroad, bringing the cheap labor here, and robotizing everything. And whatever you block off one, they'll do the other, because that's what the nature of profit-driven business is. So Mr. Trump has a good economic plan to win over the military, to win over the financial community, to win over the business community with big spending, like on the business for the infrastructure and the military, with deregulation so they can do whatever the hell they want, and with tax cuts. He's got a good plan to build, by the way, a very traditional Republican support base. The stuff for the masses is more theater. He gave them the theater they wanted during the election. I'm different, I'm tough, vote for me, not these old machines that you know are not going to help you. He's now going to demonstrate to the American people that he does exactly what the Republicans have always done, and what they're going to get is nothing. And for me, as an observer, here's the question that ought to scare you. It's not what he's doing now. It's when the American people, which could happen in a month or 6 or 12, when they figure out what I just told you, that this was all a scam, they are gonna turn on that man with an anger, a sense of betrayal, a bitterness that is gonna make him twitch. Not tweet, twitch. Okay? And that's the danger point. What is he gonna do then? When the babble doesn't work, he has to come up with something else that will distract us. And here's some candidates. War. War is an old one. Here's another one. Ratchet up the scapegoating. Maybe make those cities that are going to be sanctuaries for immigrants that don't want to, make them the bad guys. Or maybe go to more traditional scapegoats. You do know who I mean, don't you? Black people. Come on, you know. The people who've been treated this way repeatedly in American history when things got tough. That'll be the temptation. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but the temptation, the man is working himself into a corner politically and economically. He has no way to do what he promised. And what is he going to do when that becomes clear? That, as far as I can tell, that's the $64 billion question about this government as it is working its way to a dead end that is scary to contemplate. Thank you very much, all of you, for your attention.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Trump's Economic Strategy and What to Do About It, part 3 in a 3-part series with economist Richard Wolff. This program was recorded on Friday, March 24th at the Carpenters Regional Council here in Kansas City, Missouri. The forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived forum podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by the KKFI. Remember, you can also find archived forum podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next Wednesday at 6 p.m. for another forum presentation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.